I'm interviewing Karen Nussbaum in her home in Washington, D.C. on November 16th, 2006. Karen, you came to 9to5 out of a social movement background. Tell me about that. What was that like?
I often think of the most important description of myself is that I was 18 in 1968, and that it was a period when the world was kind of an open wound, and everything was possible, and every point of investigation was available, and that there was an impulse to believe that you had a responsibility to make things better. And so I came out of both a Jewish tradition of social justice and concern about civil rights. I could see firsthand the contradictions that women exhibited, especially between their competencies in their private lives versus their public lives. You know, the ones who were powerful in the public often had the worst personal relationships, and the ones who were extremely powerful in their own homes felt disabled in public, disempowered as public actors. And so that was what became important to me in trying to pursue more around women's issues or organizing women. But I was also really formed by the movement around the war in Vietnam, which became a whole analysis around anti-imperialism. And what was so important about that was an emphasis and really the need to study. You had to understand it. It was complicated. It wasn't about your gut feeling, or it could be about your gut feelings, but there was so much more to it than that. And so we studied. We read political theorists. We, you know, felt like we had to understand what was at work, because it wasn't anything that you could just observe and analyze for yourself. You had to, and so that became part of who I was and my political tradition. And though, you know, I read Gramsci and Fanon and Braverman and all that stuff, and it never really, I never like took notes and then decided what to do the next day at 9to5. It still, I think, gave me an analytical frame of mind that was fun, you know, and was illuminating and made it easier to think that you could really understand what was going on around you.
Had you been started college in 68 too?
I just graduated high school, and so I was going to, went to college in the fall of 1968 in Chicago. And
did the reading begin there at all, or?
No, but it was like, well, I dropped out, it's when I dropped out of college that I started to read, you know, which I did the next year. Mm-hmm. And so it's more when I became a political activist that I really paid much more, you know, got interested in what you could learn from books and how useful that could be, how that could answer questions that you were actually interested in answering.
What do you think was your very first organizing?
My first organizing? Oh, you know, I was like in the Brownies or something. I was, you know, but I was
ran
always
for president of something.
Yeah, right. Actually, I was in high school. In my high school, I decided to run for president of my class when I was a junior, which would have made me for the senior class. And I did it because no girl had ever been president, you know. And it wasn't like even there was a context for that in 1967 or whatever it was. And I also hated the guy, who Mike Siegel, who was running. And so I just did it to like mess with the whole thing. I didn't care that I lost. I did lose, but. But then the other element of this is the youth culture. And the youth culture was actually really central, I think, to our generation building these organizations that we did in the late 60s and the early 70s. Because you felt like it was you were entitled to be a full-fledged actor in the world, and there were opportunities to do that, and you didn't even feel like mattered that you were not particularly well informed, or, you know, that it was both a kind of a sense of entitlement, but and also with it both a sense of obligation and that you could be gratified by doing that as well. And so the youth culture was, I think, really important in the whole mix of my sense that you could, of being able to do the organizing I did later.
You mean it was almost like the youth had a special primary role in society and we were about to take it on and show the way? So I sort of remember that feeling.
Well, there was that, but also there was this vacuum, and it never occurred to me that I would go, that you needed to go work for someone else to do this. Now, I did like apprentice myself in the peace movement. I saw who knew what they were doing and I went and like trailed them around. Sid Peck. I decided that I wanted to learn how to raise money. And so I asked Sid Peck if he would teach me how to raise money. And so I would go around to meetings with him and, you know, or other people, you know, I'd figure out, oh, that'd be interesting if I could figure out how to do this or that. And so I would go to try to find people and learn how to do that when I was active in the anti-war movement in Boston. But certainly now in the labor movement, young people come in and they have to fit into this whole structure that's got like a million people older than them already being the boss. And we just didn't have that. We just like, you know, we'll go start our own thing.
Yeah. Do you remember any of those early organizing experiences in the anti-war movement? Do you feel like you learned important things? Those failures as well as their possible successes?
Well, now that I think back on it, I feel like my choices were very canny. So, for example, in the People's Coalition for Peace and Justice, which was our anti-war organization in Boston, I was working half-time as a secretary to earn money, to, you know, make my living, and then the other half-time I was working at this People's Coalition for Peace and Justice. And I took on as my job organizing high school students around the war. And it was like a really smart thing to do, right? I was 2 years older than them or something, but I was enough older that it was a group that I could practice on. You know, I could just like try to organize them, and there was not much to lose, and you know, that you could, it seemed like an easy place for me to learn basic organizing skills. And it turned out to be true, you know, that it was, I got to feel capable, because I was a little bit older than them, but, and they weren't really very demanding. You know, it was great to have like this 19-year-old, 20-year-old who could drive, you know, coming to their high schools and holding meetings with them and everything. And so it was a way for me to learn in practice what would work and what didn't work and develop basic organizing skills.
And so let's make the transition then into organizing clerical workers. You can tell us briefly how you began that and what was your early thinking about what you would have to do to organize clerical workers.
Well, it began with this realization that here I was working as a clerical worker so that I could do my organizing, and then realizing that I could do my organizing on the job too. and also the realization about in my grappling with how do you deal with the role of women in society. And I was always I was never interested in it in its own regard, you know, that as some separate bubble of concern, but more in relation to women as actors in their roles in the world. So I was always much more interested in either, you know, at the level of world peace or fighting imperialism or class, and trying to also pursue qualities of equality and women's empowerment in those contexts, as opposed to just as a separate set of issues around women's self-realization. And I've told this story before, but about the these waitresses at Cronin's restaurant in Boston, in Harvard Square, who, this is just like this local restaurant that had been around forever and had these working class women who were career waitresses, and just they had just been infected by all the aura of women's equality that was just bubbling around at that time, and got pissed off at some insult from the employer and decided that they would organize their own union, this is all eight of them, and go on strike. You know, that was kind of the impulsiveness that was around in those days. And so they did. They created the Harvard Square Waitresses Organizing Committee and went on strike and stayed on strike for like a year. And the whole thing was hopeless. They could never possibly win, but they did succeed in getting a group of, you know, supporters who would go out and picket with them, and I took picket duty every Wednesday night. And it was as I walked around in the circle for my hour or two every Wednesday night that I began to realize the potential that existed in combining the desire for women to be first-class citizens and in the workplace, you know, confronting the power of an employer with the power of women's rights. And that was really the genesis for me for the idea of 9 to 5 and how you could do that in my kind of workplace and with the women that I was working with. And so we tried little groups in at my own workplace, and what was interesting to me there was that you could call a meeting and people would come. It was amazing. And we had trouble figuring out, well, what do you do next? How do you build an organization that feels like it has an arc, you know, a beginning and a middle and an end to campaigns and so on. And that's what we learned later through getting training and organizing, and Ellen Cassidy tells the story of the Midwest Academy. I can't remember the question you asked.
Oh, no, bringing some of these things you learned about organizing into your clerical work or organizing life. Yeah.
So, right, it was both, you know, what was easy about anti-war organizing is that the war created your arc. You know, it was forces outside of you that determined what your next, where your strategy mm-hmm. needed to go, and certainly there were endless choices about what you would do, but there were forces much bigger than us that were determining what was going to happen, and we played a different kind of role. What was interesting about worker organizing was that we had to make it all up. We had to create the dynamic tension. We had to build the fight between the boss and the workers, because otherwise the whole problem was that there was stasis in the workplace, or there were individuals battling bosses, but mm-hmm. without organization, there wasn't a dynamism to the tension that would impel things forward or, you know, create a dialectic. And so we had to do that, and that's what we had to learn to do differently with workers in the workplace. The other special requirement for organizing in the workplace is that you've got a finite number of people. So if you like blow it with the people in the workplace, you're done. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like the peace movement. You know, mm-hmm. if you turn somebody off or you say the wrong thing, well, there's literally a million other people you can go to next. Or community organizing mm-hmm. is that way as well. But when you're talking about 150 people in the workplace and you make a mistake with a leader, you're done. And so that's a real discipline that we had to learn, and puts a special kind of extra tension and torque to the organizing.
So what would you say were the organizing techniques then that followed from these two observations you just made about having to create your own goals, your own campaigns, and having to proceed carefully? What did you do in your first years to make sure
you know,
follow
like,
those rules?
End up in tears a lot. You know, it's like it creates incredible tension on the organizer, for one thing, because you lose more often. But on the other hand, it wasn't like the kind of tension that existed around fighting to end a war, where you felt like in your name people were dying every day. You know, so that was its the other. there felt like there was nothing optional around fighting to end the war in Vietnam, and there was almost an optional quality for creating an organization for women office workers that gave it a kind of freedom. You weren't going to ruin anybody's life. When we started to do union organizing, though, and particularly as employers got more vicious about it, then you began to feel again that you had people's lives in your hands. It wasn't just you were going to blow the campaign, but you could make a mistake and it wouldn't affect you because you'd still have your job as an organizer, but they might lose their job in the workplace. So what it meant for us was that we had to develop a real coherent strategy and if not a science, around how we built campaigns. And that was both around the campaign issues, but also about how you dealt with individuals, really rules for engagement. And then that's what we did in our own way in 9 to 5, that we kind of rewrote the rules for engagement in our own terms.
And can you describe some of those early campaigns or early steps at organizing that would illustrate what you're saying?
Yes. So we started by making it personal, and that was different from the typical kind of organizing that was going on at the time. The typical organizing was you stood at the plant gate and you handed out leaflets and you tried somehow that was going to get you workers. And instead, we would either sometimes use 9 to 5, the association, or do it directly through District 9 to 5, but use these surveys and talk to women individually and assume that there were going to be 5 conversations with each individual before you could get them to make a commitment to sign a card or, take the next step of committing to a union campaign. And so it was this very intensive one-on-one kind of organizing that we assumed was the way we had to do the work. And it grew out of the 9 to 5 work that we did, where you would meet with people individually and you'd talk with them and you'd give them a little bit of something to do and then you'd give them a little bit more. And while it wasn't about becoming anybody's friend, it was about having a personal engagement with the people that you wanted to bring in.
Okay, so you described really what was very different about 9 to 5's approach to union organizing. When you start, after you talk to these people individually, for District 9 to 5 organizing, what was the next step then? In other words, you were trying, were you not, to form committees in the workplace so that then the workers you'd convince would go around and campaign for a union.
Yeah, and I think that the way we did our organizing in some ways was enlightened organizing. It wasn't that we made up how you did the organizing. We were kind of in the best new tradition of organizing, that it was, that you paid close attention to the workers, and you built committees, and you made committees that were big enough that they, and they all had contacts. You really built an organization that had layers, and that you could map out every single person in the workplace, and you could evaluate where they were, if they were going to be with you or not, and make decisions about where you needed to expand. And so what we did was really good organizing, and it wasn't unique, it was just good.
Very thorough.
Yeah. So I think it was more in the way we, the way we built our organization, how we developed our staff, how we structured leadership, the kinds of issues, and who we brought in. Those were the things that were more unique, and that culture really grew out of the organization that we built when we built 9 to 5, the association. That building the association was really clean slate work. We could do whatever we wanted. And then we took that into the union world, and luckily did it, again, operating as a kind of a bubble inside, a protected bubble inside this otherwise incredibly bureaucratic organization with a lot of rules, and didn't really feel like we needed to apply those rules in our own case. The only rules that we had were the real-life rules of you had to win a majority in order to get members, then you had to be able to get a contract in order to get dues, and you needed dues in order to pay your staff to do more organizing. So we had a discipline that we had to follow, but we didn't have, that was about winning, but it wasn't a discipline that was about satisfying your own boss or, you know, doing things the way that always, doing things the way they had always been done. Mm-hmm.
Now, you as a founder of 9 to 5 and head of that association, Women, Working Women, were also the president of District 9 to 5. And you were trying to keep those things somehow going in parallel. Could you describe a little bit about what your strategy was in doing those two things together?
Mm-hmm. We started 9 to 5, the association, because we saw this opportunity. Here we were office workers, and we thought we could organize, and that this would be the way we could bring other people like ourselves, or women working in offices, into an organization. And it was after our experience in 9 to 5 for a year or two that we realized that the kind of power that we would build up was so episodic that you couldn't ever consolidate any gains. You know, so we would run a campaign on the banking industry, and then we would get some demands met in the banking industry, and then that campaign would be over, and then we would run a campaign on winning maternity benefits, but that you could never consolidate power institutionally. And that's when we hit upon the National Labor Relations Act, and it's right there for us, and yeah. Began to understand what you could do with a union. And But it was very important to us to maintain the culture that we had built and move that into the trade union movement. That what we wanted to do was both build power for women on the job, but use the power of women to transform the labor movement. So it was to operate in both directions at the same time.
And by transform the labor movement, do you mean make it more cognizant of all the working women's issues, promoting women in leadership? What do you mean by transforming the movement?
For me, it was illuminated in a small demonstration that I witnessed in, I was like 1970 or 72 or something. I was in Washington at a big, million-person anti-war demonstration, and off to the side, right in front of the Justice Department or something, there was like 20 people. It was like a PL breakaway demonstration at Progressive Labor Party, mm-hmm. for the transcriber, who was, and they had this chant, and the chant was, "What are the unions for? General strike to end the war." And I thought, I never thought of unions as being institutions that could, you know, motor progressive change. And because from my context, you know, the labor unions had been supporters of the war, at least what you saw in the public media. And it wasn't, and I didn't come out of a labor background in my family, it wasn't an issue, and I hadn't learned anything about unions or workers when I was growing up. And so understanding that institutions of workers, organizations of workers could be used to transform society, not just work relations, but the way all of society works. That was what we wanted to do. We wanted to both create a place where women could exercise power within workers' organizations, but also have workers' organizations take on a larger agenda in the world.
Now, you've alluded to the fact that you paid a lot of attention to training your worker leaders and staff and so forth. What were the various approaches you had to training? What settings did you do this training? What was your goal with the training?
We first worked on this in 9 to 5, the association. To us, training was always part of the actual work of the organization, that it was the best training was always in the doing. And so we developed these campaigns around issues that would both educate our members about the issue, educate the public about the issue, but also create this give and take, you know, the programmatic arc to make things happen. So, for example, when we first started 9 to 5, affirmative action just started to be promoted, and like, you couldn't even figure out what those words meant. What did affirmative action mean? And so we did a whole, we decided that we would do a campaign where we would teach people what affirmative action was. And we had a big conference. This is all in Boston. We had a big conference about affirmative action. And then we had specific campaigns that each of our committees did where they pursued what affirmative action meant in their industry. And then we did campaigns where we went after government agencies to enforce affirmative action. So we did this whole set of activities over the course of a year that was training in its own way, but it was also campaigning and moving things and winning things and getting people engaged. But the other thing that we were committed to was a combination of action and then analysis, and looking at, okay, what is the effect of the work that we're doing? And so after we'd worked on government enforcement and those kinds of activities for a couple of years, we realized that what we were teaching our members was that government was the enemy, because all of our focus had been on getting government to do its job to enforce the laws. And we realized that, well, that's not really what we want people to think. It's the employer that's the enemy. And so we changed what we were doing. We did a whole set of campaigns that was focused on the industries or the biggest employer in different industries and going after them for changes. And then we looked at, you know, and then the 9 to 5 movie happened. And while I wish I could say that we had dreamed up that we should have the 9 to 5 movie, we didn't know what to make of it. So there's this whole 9 to 5 movie. But then we did a whole educational campaign around it. So Jane Fonda went to a dozen cities and did events, and then I went around the country and did this tour, 20-city tour, called The Movement Behind the Movie. And so we figured out how you did this interplay between kind of popular culture or you know, public activism and changing the public debate. So we're always very conscious of it and looking for opportunities to do that. We did it around the introduction of automation, which we realized as it first began in a really big way in the mid-70s, was going to transform the workplace. But once its business was done, you know, that people would be open to an organizing opportunity or to rethinking their place in the world or their work relationship while at the period when they were most kind of irritated by the change or most unsettled by the change. And so we did this 5-year concentrated campaign on computerization and automation, again, as a way to kind of just get at people's consciousness. And so we looked at whatever opportunities there existed, would analyze how you, what the effect was having, and combine direct training with campaign activities and individuals coming into all of that work.
In your phrase, getting at people's consciousness, are you saying your goal was really to build the National Association of Working Women larger and more chapters and more cities around these issues? Is that
well? At this time, we had operated 9 to 5, the association, for only a couple of years before we started the union 9 to 5, and we saw these as sister organizations that they shared a sense about who we were organizing and in what way around issues and so on, but the but it was, and that we could use 9 to 5 as a way to raise issues and kind of like, you know, the dogs that get the pigeons out of the, you know,
the hunting dogs that chase them.
Yeah, they get the
grouse or whatever.
Yeah,
that can be shot
those
down.
Birds out of the right, out of the bushes and you know, out into the up into the sky. And that 9 to 5 could do that, kind of get out there, raise these issues, get people stirred up, and then looking for some solutions, and that the union would be the opportunity to try to consolidate that desire for change and turn it into institutional power. So that was always the idea, and I think we did it pretty successfully for 15 years or however long it was, that I've had this freedom to operate on issues and kind of a creativity that really just didn't exist in the union movement, neither the freedom nor the creativity. But we could use that by tying it to the union to change a little bit about what the reputation of a union could be, especially for women workers who really didn't think unions were for them.
Now, when you got your charter to do the national organizing.
I just want to say another couple things about education. Sure. But we were also really clear about direct education. So we ran these summer schools every summer where, you know, like 100 of our leaders would come in, usually on the hottest weekend in July to Philadelphia, and we did these at Bryn Mawr, which then turned out to be the site of the original Union Summer Schools for Women, which had taken place in the 30s. And those were great. They were so much fun. You know, people would come, they'd bring their banners from Pittsburgh Working Women and 9 to 5 Atlanta and, you know, from all over the country. And there'd be like 3 or 4 or 5 people maybe from each chapter. And we did, we had songs and skits, and we always brought in some like great singer, and we had these great speakers from outside. And we always had one, you know, man who was like, you know, the health and safety expert in Canada or something, but just to like mix it up. And we always did stuff about corporations. None of it was, so we tried to be expansive, so we were feeding, you know, giving people skills, but also opening their minds, you know, to be able to analyze the world and, you know, and to have fun with each other. And so it was just great. It was a lot of fun, and we would do that then back in each of our the chapters out there. And we continued that tradition in our union, so that our annual meetings for our union were not at all typical union meetings, where, you know, you have politicians, and you read the minutes, and you, you know, and it's like, instead, we would bring all of our members together for our annual meetings for the union, and we, again, we had songs and skits. I used to do brain teasers. Then we would get, people would get a new clue at each time there was a plenary session. And people, you know, it was fun. People got into it. We had a scavenger hunt in the hotel in Cincinnati one year, and people are like roaming around the hotel for an hour finding this stuff. And so it was, you know, it had its own, we had this commitment to skills, understanding the world, and knowing how to run your own organization. You know, and what it ended up was a sense of real ownership of the organization.
Now, these summer schools were just a weekend, or were they a little longer than that?
No, the summer schools were just a weekend. Yeah.
You crammed a lot.
Because nobody could
weekend.
Get
yeah.
time off from work
That's
more than
true.
That. Yeah.
And how many years would you say the summer schools took place?
A long time. Like 10 years. Yeah, something like that. They're probably, actually, they probably happened the entire time. I mean, after I left as well. And in some form, they may still go on. Yeah.
Is there Anything you want to add about the sort of struggles to build District 925 among clerical workers, public service workers, you know, the strategies for identifying new areas to organize?
Ironically, we started to do union organizing just as union organizing was closing down. And so the tactics that we had felt had worked so well for us in, you know, liberating this sense of power in women workers, it just came up against a too formidable an enemy. The corporate power structure decided they were not having any more of union power, and we got caught right in the crux of that. And we also were, as Andy Stern says in his remarks, we were, what we were so good at of movement building, really, was forced then to succeed in the most narrow terms of a union structure that was actually pretty hostile to having something new taking place. And so we had to then turn out to be the best widget makers as well. And it was really hard to do both, because we really couldn't catch a break, either on the employer side or on the union side, in a way.
Now, I know that you, District 925, had some real successes in some, you know, major campaigns, particularly in universities and libraries. Was it simply that it wasn't enough workers fast enough to fit into the SEIU requirements at that point?
We actually, you know, had a great win record. Mm-hmm. We did really good organizing. Our organizers were wonderful. We were doing as good as anybody else, but we weren't in a position to score big. And we hadn't, at that time, figured out how to do that on our own, and neither had the institution, neither had SEIU. Now, SEIU has gotten very sophisticated about leveraging power since then, but at the time, really, the whole union movement was floundering. And so it was, so we were doing fine for what the opportunities were, but because we started at zero with nothing, it wasn't enough.
Do you want to say a little bit about the dilemmas or thoughts you had about, dilemmas you felt, thoughts you had about taking the job with the Women's Bureau when it was offered to you by the Clinton administration?
Yes, I was offered the job to be the director of the Women's Bureau at the Department of Labor, and that was, I've been put up for the job by actually John Sweeney and John Hyatt, the general counsel at SEIU, and at first I thought, you know, oh no, I want to just stay with my union, and you know, that I'm, this is really, you know, where I can make my contribution. And it was interesting because I went and got the, I was interviewed by Secretary of Labor Bob Reich, and and I went to go see John Sweeney right afterwards because I was in Washington, and he asked me, okay, so where, now what's happening? And I said to him, well, I told Secretary Reich that I would call him back after the weekend and let him know, and he said, are you out of your mind? How can you, are you crazy? You'd rather stay running your local union instead of going to do this job at the Department of Labor? You know, open your mind. And I thought, oh, okay, that's good advice. And and he was right, you know, that it was, it wasn't anything that precious about what I was doing, that that I couldn't learn more or do more, you know, experience from being in such a different experience really enriched myself and my organizing.
And the union would continue with the other people.
Yeah, right. And it's not like I felt like I was essential, because and that was always what was so cool about 9 to 5 was that we you know, had such a collaborative approach to doing the organizing and had such great, incredibly competent people at all levels of the organization. So it wasn't like the organization was in jeopardy. It was more, actually, it was a kind of a humility about being an organizer.
Yeah, identifying so much with the union as opposed to.
Yeah. But then it turned out to be a gas to operate in this completely different way because it was just all these new experiences.
Well, I think for the District 9 to 5 archives, it would be good to include sort of a brief summary of your, you know, your vision and your activities while you were there. And I think it was three or four years?
3 years.
3 years, yeah.
Yeah.
Head of the Women's Bureau.
Well, I went in and I used all of my skills that I had developed in 9 to 5, actually. And within about 4 or 5 weeks, I had this whole plan about what to do in the first 3 years that I would be there. Because it just, you know, I went in thinking, well, you need to build a kind of programmatic arc that makes sense. And actually, that plan really pretty much played out. To me, it meant having these unbelievable resources. I had 80 staff and a budget of like $10 million. And I represented the federal government, you know, and I could just like go places and say things and do things that, you know, I never thought you could do before. And I remember early on making a speech somewhere and giving a kind of speech that I would typically give about things and interrupting myself in the speech and saying, is this what government says? And over time coming, realizing that, you know, my goal was to try to bring as much of organizing into the work that I was doing and use this different vantage point. So to use government to leverage power around for working women and on issues that would help working women get mobilized. And so we had so much fun. We took up all these issues. I got to go into, for example, I got to go investigate the strike at Diamond Walnut, which had been this ongoing, it might have been a lockout of these workers in a walnut farm, and they'd been on strike or been locked out for a long time.
In California.
Uh-huh. And so I got to go, and I'm meeting with management, and I'm meeting with the union and the workers, and then we convened a community meeting to see whether, you know, the community shouldn't get involved. Or I went to Las Vegas, and I met with, I had a hearing about the issues of health and safety and sexual harassment that were affecting casino workers. And, you know, I met with television writers in New York to find out what their issues were and how we could address them. And so I got to investigate and, you know, work with and expose the working conditions of women in all these different kinds of jobs. And we, you know, wrote reports and, you know, just, but we had it from this platform that was unbelievable. And then we did this giant survey, you know, the survey to end all surveys. We'd always done surveys, you know, through the 20 years at 9 to 5. And then we did the survey, but because we were the federal government, we got 10 daily newspapers to run the survey in the newspaper. And, you know, we had literally 1,000 different partners. We ran the survey in 8 different languages. It went all over the place. We ended up with 300,000 responses. And so then that gave us the basis for, you know, making the policy changes. Well, working women told us this is what we need to do, but also it's just organizing on this unbelievable scale. And it was just, it was wonderful. It was just exhilarating. It was so great. You know, then you have the president releasing the report, you know. And then I got to be, I was the director on the occasion of the 75th anniversary of the Women's Bureau, and so we held this giant event to celebrate the 75th anniversary. And it just, there were these great opportunities to do things on a really big scale, and it opened my mind beyond office workers, and so I could understand the working conditions of women in so many other occupations and parts of the world and different conditions. So it broadened me a tremendous amount, and it also helped me understand operating within a completely different bureaucracy. And we had created our own, you know, kind of breathing room within 9 to 5, but we still operated within SEIU, which was a, you know, very bureaucratic male operation. And then I was in the federal government, and it really developed my bureaucratic skills, which are quite well developed now. So.
You mean dealing with bureaucracy,
yes,
as opposed,
yes,
to being bureaucratic.
Right. Promoting bureaucracy, right. I'll pause here for a second.